Chapter 6. It may remain for us to learn that our task is only beginning, and that there will never be given to us even the ghost of any help save the help of unutterable and unthinkable time. We may have to learn that the infinite whirl of death and birth, out of which we cannot escape, is of our own creation, of our own seeking. That the forces integrating worlds are the errors of the past. That the eternal sorrow is but the eternal hunger of insatiable desire. And that the burnt-out suns are rekindled only by the inextinguishable passions of vanished lives. Lafcadio O'Hearn, Out of the East. George Orr's apartment was on the top floor of an old frame house, a few blocks up the hill on Corbett Avenue, a shabby part of town where most of the houses were getting on for a century or well beyond it. He had three large rooms, a bathroom with a deep clawfoot tub, and a view between roofs to the river, up and down which passed ships, pleasure boats, logs, gulls, great turning flights of pigeons. He perfectly remembered his other flat, of course. The one room 8.5 by 11 with the pull-out stove and balloon bed and co-op bathroom down the linoleum hall on the 18th floor of the Corbett condominium tower, which had never been built. He got off the trolley at Whiteacre Street and walked up the hill and up the broad, dark stairs. He let himself in, dropped his briefcase on the floor and his body on the bed, and let go. He was terrified, anguished, exhausted, bewildered. "I've got to do something. I've got to do something," he kept telling himself frantically, but he did not know what to do. He had never known what to do. He had always done what seemed to want doing, the next thing to be done, without asking questions, without forcing himself, without worrying about it. But that sureness of foot had deserted him when he began taking drugs, and by now he was quite astray. He must act. He had to act. He must refuse to let Haber use him any longer as a tool. He must take his destiny into his own hands. He spread out his hands and looked at them, then sank his face into them. It was wet with tears. Oh, hell. Hell, he thought bitterly. What kind of man am I? Tears in my beard? No wonder Haber uses me. How could he help it? I haven't any strength. I haven't any character. I'm a born tool. I haven't any destiny. All I have is dreams. And now other people run them. I must get away from Haber, he thought, trying to be firm and decisive, but even as he thought it, he knew he wouldn't. Haber had him hooked, and with more than one hook. A dream configuration so unusual, indeed unique, Haber had said, was invaluable to research. Orr's contribution to human knowledge was going to prove immense. Orr believed that Haber meant this and knew what he was talking about. The scientific aspect of it all was, in fact, the only hopeful one to his mind. It seemed to him that perhaps science might wring some good out of his peculiar and terrible gift, put it to some good ends, compensating a little for the enormous harm it had done. The murder of 6 billion non-existent people. Orr's head ached fit to split. He ran cold water in the deep cracked washbasin and dunked his whole face in for half a minute at a time, coming up red, blind, and wet as a newborn baby. Haber had a moral line on him then, but where he really had him caught was on the legal hook. If Orr quit voluntary therapy, he became liable to prosecution for obtaining drugs illegally and would be sent to jail or the nuthatch. No way out there. And if he didn't quit, but merely cut sessions and failed to cooperate, Haber had an effective instrument of coercion, the dream-suppressing drugs which Orr could obtain only on his prescription. He was more uneasy than ever, at the idea of dreaming spontaneously without control now. In the state he was in, and having been conditioned to dream effectively every time in the laboratory, he did not like to think what might happen if he dreamed effectively without the rational restraints imposed by hypnosis. It would be a nightmare, a worse nightmare than the one he had just had in Haber's office. Of that he was sure, and he dared not let it happen. He must take the dream suppressants. That was the one thing he knew he must do, the thing that must be done. But he could do it only so long as Haber let him, and therefore he must cooperate with Haber. He was caught, rat in a trap, running a maze for the mad scientist and no way out. No way. No way. But he's not a mad scientist, or thought Dolly. He's a pretty sane one, or he was. It's the chance of power that my dreams give him that twists him around. He keeps acting a part, and this gives him such an awfully big part to play. So that now he's using even his science as a means, not an end. But his ends are good, aren't they? He wants to improve life for humanity. Is that wrong? His head was aching again. He was underwater when the telephone rang. He hastily tried to rub his face and hair dry and returned to the dark bedroom, groping. Hello, Orr here? This is Heather LaLash, said a soft, suspicious alto. An irrelevant and poignant sensation of pleasure rose in him, like a tree that grew up and flowered all in one moment, with its roots in his loins and its flowers in his mind. Hello, he said again. Do you want to meet me sometime to talk about this? Yes, certainly. Well, I don't want you thinking that there's any case to be made using that machine thing, the augmenter. That seems to be perfectly in line. It's had extensive laboratory trial, and he's had all the proper checks and gone through the proper channels, and now it's registered with HEW. He's a real pro, of course. I didn't realize who he was when you first talked to me. A man doesn't get to that sort of position unless he's awfully good. What position? Well, the directorship of a government-sponsored research institute. He liked the way she began her fierce, scornful sentences, so often with a weak, conciliatory, well. She cut the ground out from under them before they ever got going, let them hang unsupported in the void. She had courage, great courage. Oh, yes, I see, he said vaguely. Dr. Haber had got his directorship the day after Orr had got his cabin. The cabin dream had been during the one all-night session they had had. They never tried another. Hypnotic suggestion of dream content was insufficient to a night's dreaming. And at 3 a.m. Haber had at last given up and, hooking Orr to the augmentor, had fed him deep sleep patterns the rest of the night so that they could both relax. But the next afternoon they had had a session, and the dream Orr had dreamed during it had been so long, so confused and complicated, that he had never been altogether sure of what he had changed, what good works Haber had been accomplishing that time. He had gone to sleep in the old office and had wakened in the OOI office. Haber had got himself a promotion. But there had been more to it than that. The weather was a little less rainy, it seemed, since that dream. Perhaps other things had changed. He was not sure. He had protested against doing so much effective dreaming in so short a time. Haber had at once agreed not to push him so fast and had let him go without a session for 5 days. Haber was, after all, a benevolent man. And besides, he didn't want to kill the goose that laid the golden eggs. The goose. Precisely. That describes me perfectly, Orr thought. A damned, white, vapid, stupid goose. He had lost a bit of what Miss LaLash was saying. I'm sorry, he said. I missed something. I'm kind of thick-headed just now, I think. Are you all right? Yes, fine. Just sort of tired. You had an upsetting dream about the plague, didn't you? You looked awful after it. Do these sessions leave you this way every time? No, not always. This was a bad one. I guess you could see that. Were you arranging for us to meet? Yes, Monday for lunch, I said. You work downtown, don't you, at Bradford Industries? To his mild wonder, he realized that he did. The great water projects of Bonneville Umatilla did not exist to bring water to the giant cities of John Day and French Glen, which did not exist. There were no big cities in Oregon except Portland. He was not a draftsman for the district, but for a private tools firm downtown. He worked in the Stark Street office. Of course. Yes, he said, I'm off from 1 to 2. We could meet at Dave's on Ankeny. 1 to 2 is fine. So's Dave's. I'll see you there Monday. Wait, he said. Listen, would you mind telling me what Dr. Haber said? I mean, what he told me to dream when I was hypnotized? You heard all that, didn't you? Yes, but I couldn't do that. I'd be interfering in his treatment. If he wanted you to know, he'd tell you. It would be unethical. I can't. I guess that's right. Yes, I'm sorry. Monday, then? Goodbye, he said, suddenly overwhelmed with depression and foreboding, and put the receiver back without hearing her say goodbye. She couldn't help him. She was courageous and strong, but not that strong. Perhaps she had seen or sensed the change, but she had put it away from her, refused it. Why not? It was a heavy load to bear, that double memory. And she had no reason to undertake it, no motive for believing even for a moment a driveling psycho who claimed that his dreams came true. Tomorrow was Saturday. A long session with Haber. 4 o'clock until 6 or longer. No way out. It was time to eat, but Orr wasn't hungry. He had not turned on the lights in his high twilight bedroom, or in the living room, which he had never got around to furnishing in the 3 years he'd lived here. He wandered in there now. The windows looked out on lights and the river. The air smelled of dust and early spring. There was a wood frame fireplace, an old upright piano with 8 ivories missing, a pile of carpeting mill ends by the hearth, and a decrepit Japanese bamboo table 10 inches high. Darkness lay softly on the bare pine floor, unpolished, unswept. George Orr lay down in that mild darkness, full length, face down, the smell of the dusty wooden floor in his nostrils, the hardness of it upholding his body. He lay still, not asleep, somewhere else than sleep, farther on, farther out, a place where there are no dreams. It was not the first time he had been there. When he got up, it was to take a chlorpromazine tablet and go to bed. Iber had tried phenothiazines with him this week. They seemed to work well, to let him enter the D-state at need, but to weaken the intensity of the dream so that they never rose to the effective level. That was fine, but Iber said that the effect would lessen, just as with all the other drugs, until there was no effect at all. Nothing will keep a man from dreaming, he had said, but death. This night, at least, he slept deep, and if he dreamed, the dreams were fleeting without weight. He didn't wake until nearly noon on Saturday. He went to his refrigerator and looked in it. He stood contemplating it a while. There was more food in it than he had ever seen in a private refrigerator in his life, in his other life. The one lived among 7 billion others, where the food, such as it was never enough. Where an egg was the luxury of the month. Today we ovulate, his half-wife had used to say when she bought their egg ration. Curious, in this life they hadn't had a trial marriage, he and Donna. There was no such thing, legally speaking, in the post-plague years. There was full marriage only. In Utah, since the birth rate was still lower than the death rate, they were even trying to reinstitute polygamous marriage, for religious and patriotic reasons, but He and Donna hadn't had any kind of marriage this time. They had just lived together. But still it hadn't lasted. His attention returned to the food in the refrigerator. He was not the thin, sharp-boned man he had been in the world of the 7 billion. He was quite solid, in fact. But he ate a starving man's meal, an enormous meal, hard-boiled eggs, buttered toast, anchovies, jerky, celery, cheese, walnuts, a piece of cold halibut spread with mayonnaise, lettuce, pickled beets, chocolate cookies, anything he found on his shelves. After this orgy, he felt physically a great deal better. He thought of something as he drank some genuine non-ersatz coffee that actually made him grin. He thought, in that life, yesterday, I dreamed an effective dream which obliterated 6 billion lives and changed the entire history of humankind for the past quarter century. But in this life, which I then created, I did not dream an effective dream. I was in Haber's office all right, and I dreamed, but it didn't change anything. It's been this way all along, and I merely had a bad dream about the plague years. There's nothing wrong with me. I don't need therapy. He had never looked at it this way before, and it amused him enough that he grinned, but not particularly happily. He knew he would dream again. It was already past 2. He washed up, found his raincoat, real cotton, a luxury in the other life, and set off on foot to the Institute, a couple of miles walk up past the medical school and then farther up into Washington Park. He could have got there by the trolleys, of course, but they were sporadic and roundabout, and anyhow, there was no rush. It was pleasant, passing through the warm March rain, the unbustling streets. The trees were leafing out, the chestnuts ready to light their candles. The crash, the carcinomic plague that had reduced the human population by 5 billion in 5 years, and another billion in the next 10, had shaken the civilizations of the world to their roots, and yet left them in the end intact. It had not changed anything radically, only quantitatively. The air was still profoundly and irremediably polluted. That pollution predated the crash by decades, indeed was its direct cause. It didn't harm anybody much now except the newborn. The plague, in its leukemoid variety, still selectively, thoughtfully as it were, picked off 1 out of 4 babies born and killed it within 6 months. Those who survived were virtually cancer-resistant. But there are other griefs. No factories spewed smoke down by the river. No cars ran fouling the air with exhaust. What few there were steamers or battery-powered. There were no songbirds anymore, either. The effects of the plague were visible in everything. It was itself still endemic, and yet it hadn't prevented war from breaking out. In fact, the fighting in the Near East was more savage than it had been in the more crowded world. The United States was heavily committed to the Israeli-Egyptian side in weapons, munitions, planes, and military advisors by the regiment. China was in equally deep on the Iraq-Iran side, though she hadn't yet sent in Chinese soldiers, only Tibetans, North Koreans, Vietnamese, and Mongolians. Russia and India were holding uneasily aloof, but now that Afghanistan and Brazil were going in with the Iranians, Pakistan might jump in on the Israel-Egypt side. India would then panic and line up with China, which might scare the USSR enough to push her in on the US side. This gave a lineup of 12 nuclear powers in all, 6 to a side. So went the speculations. Meanwhile, Jerusalem was rubble, and in Saudi Arabia and Iraq, the civilian population was living in burrows in the ground, while tanks and planes sprayed fire in the air and cholera in the water, and babies crawled out of the burrows blinded by napalm. They were still massacring whites in Johannesburg, or noticed on a headline at a corner newspaper stand. Years now since the uprising, and there were still whites to massacre in South Africa. People are tough. The rain fell warm, polluted, gentle on his bare head as he climbed the gray hills of Portland. In the office, with the great corner window that looked out into the rain, he said, "Please, Stop using my dreams to improve things, Dr. Haber. It won't work. It's wrong. I want to be cured. That's the one essential prerequisite to your cure, George. Wanting it. You're not answering me. But the big man was like an onion. Slip off layer after layer of personality, belief, response, infinite layers, no end to them, no center to him. Nowhere that he ever stopped, had to say, here I stay. No being, only layers. You're using my effective dreams to change the world. You won't admit to me that you're doing it, why not? George, you must realize that you ask questions that from your point of view may seem reasonable, but which from my point of view are literally unanswerable. We don't see reality the same way. Near enough the same to be able to talk. Yes, fortunately, but not always to be able to ask and answer. Not yet. I can answer your questions, and I do. But anyway, look, you can't go on changing things, trying to run things. You speak as if that were some kind of general moral imperative. He looked at Orr with his genial, reflective smile, stroking his beard. But in fact, isn't that man's very purpose on earth? To do things? Change things? Run things? Make a better world? No. What is his purpose, then? I don't know. Things don't have purposes, as if the universe were a machine where every part has a useful function. What's the function of a galaxy? I don't know if our life has a purpose, and I don't see that it matters. What does matter is that we're a part, like a thread in a cloth or a grass blade in a field. It is, and we are. What we do is like wind blowing on the grass. There was a slight pause, and when Haber answered, his tone was no longer genial, reassuring, or encouraging. It was quite neutral and verged, just detectably, on contempt. You're of a peculiarly passive outlook for a man brought up in the Judeo-Christian rationalist West, a sort of natural Buddhist. Have you ever studied the Eastern mysticisms, George? The last question, with its obvious answer, was an open sneer. No, I don't know anything about them. I do know that it's wrong to force the pattern of things. It won't do. It's been our mistake for 100 years. Don't you see what happened yesterday? The opaque, dark eyes met his, straight on. What happened yesterday, George? No way. No way out. Haber was using thiopental sodium on him now, to lower his resistance to hypnotic procedures. He submitted to the shot, watching the needle slip with only a moment of pain into the vein of his arm. This was the way he had to go. He had no choice. He had never had any choice. He was only a dreamer. Haber went off somewhere to run something while the drug took effect. But he was back promptly in 15 minutes, gusty, jovial, and indifferent. All right, let's get on with it, George. Or knew with dreary clarity what he would get on with today. The war. The papers were full of it. Even Orr's news-resistant mind had been full of it, coming here. The growing war in the Near East. Haber would end it. And no doubt the killings in Africa. For Haber was a benevolent man. He wanted to make the world better for humanity. The end justifies the means. But what if there never is an end? All we have is means. Orr lay back on the couch and shut his eyes. The hand touched his throat. You will enter the hypnotic state now, George, said Haber's deep voice. You are dark. In the dark. Not quite night yet. Late twilight on the fields. Clumps of trees looked black and moist. The road he was walking on picked up the faint last light from the sky. It ran long and straight, an old country highway, cracked blacktop. A goose was walking ahead of him, about 15 feet in advance and visible only as a white, bobbing blur. Now and then it hissed a little. The stars were coming out, white as daisies. A big one was blooming just to the right of the road, low over the dark country, tremulously white. When he looked up at it again, it had already become larger and brighter. "It's enhancing," he thought. It seemed to grow reddish as it brightened. It enreddened, huged. The eyes swam. Small blue-green streaks zipped about it, zigzagging brownian, roundian, roundian. A vast and creamy halo pulsated about Big Star, and tiny zips, fainter, clearer, pulsing. "Oh, no, no, no," he said, as the Big Star brightened hugely, burst, blinding. He fell to the ground, covering his head with his arms, as the sky burst into streaks of bright death, but could not turn onto his face, must behold and witness. The ground swung up and down, great trembling wrinkles passing through the skin of earth. "Let be! Let be!" he screamed aloud, with his face against the sky, and woke on the leather couch. He sat up and put his face in his sweaty, shaking hands. Presently he felt Haber's hand heavy on his shoulder. "Bad time again? Damn, I thought I'd let you off easy. Told you to have a dream about peace."
"I did."
"But it was disturbing to you?" "I was watching a battle in space." "Watching it? From where?"
"Earth."
He recounted the dream briefly, omitting the goose.
"I don't know whether they got one of ours or we got one of theirs."
Haber laughed. "I wish we could see what goes on out there. We'd feel more involved. But of course those encounters take place at speeds and distances that human vision simply isn't equipped to keep up with. Your version's a lot more picturesque than the actuality, no doubt. Sounds like a good science fiction movie from the 70s. Used to go to those when I was a kid. But why do you think you dreamed up a battle scene when the suggestion was peace?"
"Just peace? Dream about peace, that's all you said?"
Haber did not answer at once. He occupied himself with the controls of the augmenter. "Okay," he said at last. "This once, experimentally, let's let you compare the suggestion with the dream. Perhaps we'll find out why it came out negative." "I said, no, let's run the tape." He went over to a panel in the wall.
"You tape the whole session?"
"Sure. Standard psychiatric practice. Didn't you know?"
"How could I know if it's hidden? Makes no noise signal, and you didn't tell me, or thought."
But he said nothing. Maybe it was standard practice. Maybe it was Haber's personal arrogance. But in either case, he couldn't do much about it. "Here we are. It ought to be about here. The hypnotic state now, George. You are here. Don't go under, George." The tape hissed, or shook his head and blinked. The last fragments of sentences had been Haber's voice on the tape, of course, and he was still full of the hypnosis-inducing drug. "I'll have to skip a bit." "All right." Now it was his voice on the tape again, saying, "Peace. No more mass killing of humans by other humans. No fighting in Iran and Arabia and Israel. No more genocides in Africa. No stockpiles of nuclear and biological weapons ready to use against other nations. No more research on ways and means of killing people. A world at peace with itself. Peace as a universal lifestyle on Earth. You will dream of that world at peace with itself. Now you're going to sleep. When I say..." He stopped the tape abruptly, lest they put "or" to sleep with the key word. Or rubbed his forehead. "Well," he said, "I followed instructions." "Hardly. To dream of a battle in cislunar space." Haber stopped,
as abruptly as the tape. "Sis Lunar," Orr said, feeling a little sorry for Haber. "We weren't using that word when I went to sleep. How are things in Izzergypt?" The made-up word from the old reality had a curiously shocking effect, spoken in this reality. Like surrealism, it seemed to make sense and didn't, or seemed not to make sense and did. Haber walked up and down the long, handsome room. Once he passed his hand over his red-brown, curly beard. The gesture was a calculated one and familiar to Orr, but when he spoke, Orr felt that he was seeking and choosing his words carefully, not trusting, for once, his inexhaustible fund of improvisation. "It's curious that you used the defense of Earth as a symbol or metaphor of peace, of the end of warfare, yet it's not unfitting. Only very subtle. Dreams are endlessly subtle. Endlessly. For in fact it was that threat, that immediate peril of invasion by non-communicating, reasonlessly hostile aliens, which forced us to stop fighting among ourselves, to turn our aggressive defensive energies outward, to extend the territorial drive to include all humanity, to combine our weapons against a common foe. If the aliens hadn't struck, who knows? We might actually still be fighting in the Near East." "Out of the frying pan into the fire," Orr said. "Don't you see, Dr. Haber, that that's all you'll ever get from me? Look, it's not that I want to block you, to frustrate your plans. Ending the war was a good idea. I agree with it totally. I even voted isolationist last election because Harris promised to pull us out of the Near East. But I guess I can't, or my subconscious can't even imagine a warless world. The best it can do is substitute one kind of war for another. You said no killing of humans by other humans. So I dreamed up the aliens. Your own ideas are sane and rational. But this is my unconscious you're trying to use, not my rational mind. Maybe rationally I could conceive of the human species not trying to kill each other off by nations. In fact, rationally, it's easier to conceive of than the motives of war. But you're handling something outside reason. You're trying to reach progressive humanitarian goals with a tool that isn't suited to the job. Who has humanitarian dreams?" Haber said nothing, and showed no reaction, so Orr went on. "Or maybe it's not just my unconscious, irrational mind. Maybe it's my total self, my whole being, that just isn't right for the job. I'm too defeatist, or passive, as you said, maybe. I don't have enough desires. Maybe that has something to do with my having this capacity to dream effectively. But if it doesn't, there might be others who can do it, people with minds more like your own, that you could work with better. You could test for it. I can't be the only one. Maybe I just happen to become aware of it, but I don't want to do it. I want to get off the hook. I can't take it. I mean, look, all right, the war's been over in the Near East for 6 years, fine, but now there are the aliens up on the moon. What if they land? What kind of monsters have you dredged up out of my unconscious mind in the name of peace? I don't even know."
"Nobody knows what the aliens look like, George," Haber said in a reasonable, reassuring tone. "We all have our bad dreams about them, God knows. But as you said, it's been over 6 years now since their first landing on the moon, and they still haven't made it to Earth. By now, our missile defense systems are completely efficient. There's no reason to think they'll break through now if they haven't yet. The danger period was during those first few months, before the defense was mobilized on an international cooperative basis." Orr sat a while, shoulders slumped. He wanted to yell at Haber, "Liar, why do you lie to me?" But the impulse was not a deep one. It led nowhere. For all he knew, Haber was incapable of sincerity because he was lying to himself. He might be compartmenting his mind into two hermetic halves, in one of which he knew that Orr's dreams changed reality and employed them for that purpose. In the other of which he knew that he was using hypnotherapy and dream abreaction to treat a schizoid patient who believed that his dreams changed reality. That Haber could have thus got out of communication with himself was rather
hard for Orr to conceive. His own mind was so resistant to such divisions that he was slow to recognize them in others. But he had learned that they existed. He had grown up in a country run by politicians who sent the pilots to man the bombers, to kill the babies, to make the world safe for children to grow up in. But that was in the old world now, not in the brave new one. "I am cracking," he said. "You must see that. You're a psychiatrist. Don't you see that I'm going to pieces? Aliens from outer space attacking Earth. Look, if you ask me to dream again, what will you get? Maybe a totally insane world, the product of an insane mind. Monsters, ghosts, witches, dragons, transformations, all the stuff we carry around in us, all the horrors of childhood, the night fears, the nightmares. How can you keep all that from getting loose? I can't stop it. I'm not in control."
"Don't worry about control. Freedom is what you're working toward," Haber said gustily. "Freedom. Your unconscious mind is not a sink of horror and depravity. That's a Victorian notion, and a terrifically destructive one. It crippled most of the best minds of the 19th century, and hamstrung psychology all through the first half of the 20th. Don't be afraid of your unconscious mind. It's not a black pit of nightmares, nothing of the kind. It is the wellspring of health, imagination, creativity. What we call evil is produced by civilization, its constraints and repressions, deforming the spontaneous, free self-expression of the personality. The aim of psychotherapy is precisely this, to remove those groundless fears and nightmares, to bring up what's unconscious into the light of rational consciousness, examine it objectively, and find that there is nothing to fear."
"But there is," Orr said very softly. Haber let him go at last. He came out into the spring twilight and stood a minute on the steps of the Institute with his hands in his pockets, looking at the streetlights in the city below, so blurred by mist and dusk that they seemed to wink and move like the tiny silvery shapes of tropical fish in a dark aquarium. A cable car was clanking up the steep hill toward its turnaround here at the top of Washington Park, in front of the Institute. He went out into the street and climbed aboard the car while it was turning. His walk was evasive, and yet aimless. He moved like a sleepwalker, like one impelled.